Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the arrest of a U.S. citizen for the attempted car bombing of Times Square reopens some underlying questions about the relationship between Islam and the West. If the press reports today are accurate, the suspect, Faisal Shahzad, had originally come here from Pakistan in the 90s on a student visa, earned a computer science degree and an MBA, and had a comfortable suburban home in Connecticut with a wife and two kids and a good job before quitting his job, spending 5 months in Pakistan and returning to build the bomb. His story is clearly the exception, not the rule, in Muslim America and Pakistani America, as we talked about last hour. But discussions about Islam and the West and the proper Western response to the Islamist terrorism that exists are happening around the globe in Muslim societies, Western societies, and those in which they meet. One of those ongoing conversations involves our next guest, NYU professor Paul Berman, who thinks many of his fellow Western liberals are intellectually weak or even dishonest on some of these matters, leaving themselves too soft on religious terror and religious extremism in the name of tolerance and pluralism. This debate has been ongoing in the New York Review of Books, The New Republic, and other publications, including thinkers like Berman, Ian Baruma, and Tony Judt. Paul Berman's new book is called The Flight of the Intellectuals. He joins us now. Welcome back to WNYC.
I'm glad to be here.
The Flight of the Intellectuals. Who's fleeing from what?
I think a lot of a fair number of intellectuals and journalists are fleeing from the reality in front of their eyes, which is that they're we and many people around the world are facing an authoritarian or totalitarian movement, which is not the religion of Islam, but is a political movement that claims Islam, I think falsely, but they claim it. And a lot of intellectuals and writers are fleeing from their own responsibility, which is to look at these things, look at the writers, look at the intellectuals behind that sort of thing, examine it closely, and explain to us what's happening.
You make a comparison between how the novelist Salman Rushdie was treated as a hero by Western intellectuals when Ayatollah Khomeini issued a death sentence on Rushdie in 1989 for his books that parody Muslim cultural excess, but how these same intellectuals are now more skeptical of other Muslim writers who dissent from the religious and political orthodoxy, people like Ayan Hirsi Ali and Ibn Warraq. And first, for people who don't know their stories, why do you think they are today's Salman Rushdies?
Well, the Ayan Hirsi Ali and Ibn Warraq are people from Muslim backgrounds who have had just tremendous problems, more or less equivalent to Rushdie's, if not exactly with a state like the Islamic Republic of Iran at the root of their problems. Ayan Hirsi Ali is an intellectual, a very serious political intellectual from Somalia, who fled to Holland, made herself a critic of the Islamist movement. In her case, also the whole religion of Islam. Said some provocative things, some very intelligent things, some critical things. Found herself under threat in Holland, made a movie with someone named Theo van Gogh, who's a remote collateral descendant of Vincent van Gogh, who was murdered. And she had to flee underground, eventually has been living under police protection ever since, has fled to the United States. And then, instead of being welcomed and celebrated the way Rushdie was by at least a lot of people, not by everybody, but by a lot of people, has found herself being criticized, denigrated, compared invidiously to other people, generally under assault in the liberal press or in a good number of intellectual magazines.
And it's
kind of shocking.
What is this about, do you think? Is it the underlying tension between tolerance of difference and universal values of nonviolence and freedom of thought? Or where is that tension in the intellectual world that allows that difference of treatment?
I think a lot of people have been intimidated into thinking that they must stay away from radical writers like Hirsi Ali, and that it's too dangerous to be associated with these people. These people are really the source of the problem, as if Rushdie were the source of the problem in Iran with the Ayatollah Khomeini. Instead, we should look for people who are halfway liberal but halfway anti-liberal, and think of those people as the good guys.
Is there, you know, as at the level of ideas, is there a tension between the value of pluralism and the value of freedom of thought that somewhat underlies this, or do you think that's not an issue?
Well, there is and there isn't. I mean, in principle, there's always a tension. You are free to say anything you want, but some things you can't say. So you're not allowed to cry fire in a crowded theater. So some things you can't say. But in general, you should be allowed to have a free discussion. And if there's anything we need these days, it's on these issues, a free discussion. We need a fully open discussion which involves absolutely everybody. And somebody like Hirsi Ali has a great deal to contribute in this. Also, Ibn Warraq, who you mentioned.
And listeners, this is a big conversation, and we want to get a lot of voices on here. So you can contribute in a number of different ways at 212-433-WNYC or on our website, wnyc.org. Maybe you're one of the readers of the New Republic and the New York Review of Books, and you've been following this tit-for-tat in those magazines between Ian Buruma and Paul Berman, for example, in long articles, or Tariq Ramadan, who we will get to, the Oxford University professor who some of you may remember was on the show recently. If you're kind of inside the intellectual world on that level and want to get in on the conversation, feel free. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or anyone else who wants to engage these issues in Paul Berman's book, The Flight of the Intellectuals. 212-433-9692. You know, there have been many intervening events between the fatwa on Rushdie and today, obviously, including two Iraq wars, 9/11, U.S. torture and secret detention policies, and all kinds of things. Do things like those make for a more complicated intellectual landscape than in 1989?
Well, of course they do. I think the largest intervening event, though, is the rise of the Islamist movement. That when Rushdie came under this fatwa in 1989, it seemed sort of a weird thing from out of nowhere. And Iran under Ayatollah Khomeini seemed like a planet from outer space. So it was relatively easy to defend Rushdie and think that he was under assault from aliens from Mars, and the whole thing seemed far away and exotic. Now, however, the Islamist movement has become very large. It has a great deal of power in a lot of countries. It doesn't rule any more countries apart from Iran, but it has ruled at various times other countries such as Afghanistan, and it's become a very large movement. And apart from being a large movement in itself, it's attracted a large number of, let us say, fellow travelers, of people who think there's some virtue in it, even if they don't go all the way to supporting it. And I think that's the biggest, single biggest event that's taken place between the Rushdie fatwa and now.
And Muslim listeners, we, of course, want your voices included in this conversation. Are people like Ayaan Hirsi Ali and Ibn Warraq heroes to you, free speech heroes? Certainly, Paul, we had no problem last hour when we were talking about this Times Square case in having a board full of Pakistani Americans, Muslim Americans, calling up to denounce the actor in terms very similar to what you were using before, which was that they don't consider this really part of Islam.
Well, of course. I mean, the Islamist movement has many enemies, and the real enemies of the Islamist movement are Muslims themselves. And some of those people might be like Hirsi Ali and Ibn Warraq, free thinkers who have turned away from religion themselves, and many other Muslim enemies of the Islamist movement are themselves pious Muslims with alternative interpretations of the religion that I think are truer to the main stream of Islam.
You devote a good part of the book to a critique of one Oxford University professor, Tariq Ramadan, who is very well known in Europe and the Muslim world, and who was actually banned from this country, as you know, for 6 years until very recently on what seemed to have been false charges of making a donation to a terrorist organization. Professor Ramadan was on this program recently when he finally came back to New York to speak on a panel at Cooper Union. And I want to play a clip of him in a minute reacting to you. But why write about Tariq Ramadan at great length in the first place? Why does he warrant the kind of scrutiny, this one professor from Oxford, that you give him?
Well, first of all, the false charges were true charges. He'd actually donated money to a fundraising arm of Hamas. At the time that he donated, which is illegal in the United States to do this, at the time that he did this, it was not illegal. Hamas,
Well, because Hamas had not been, it was in, it was before 9/11, Hamas had not been
put on
the list of terrorist organizations.
Right, nor the specific charity that he donated to, which has a French and a Swiss arm. So at that time, it wasn't illegal, but Hamas was certainly at that time a terrorist organization. And he did send his money, and I think he sent his money because he wanted to send his money.
The Obama administration, by the way, after he won a round in court, seems to have backed off this and has a different attitude toward whether Tariq Ramadan should be allowed in the United States than the Bush administration did. That's your understanding, right?
I also criticize the Bush administration for this. I think that Tariq Ramadan is a very interesting figure. He has interesting ideas. They should be discussed. And there's nobody in the United States who's discussed them more fully than me. So
right.
If there's anybody who believes in engaging with Tariq Ramadan,
yes.
I am that person.
So why is he worthy of this scrutiny?
He's worthy of the scrutiny because for two, three reasons. First, he does have a following in Europe and in French-speaking Africa and other places around the world. So he has a large following. Second, from the world of the Islamist movement, he is the one writer who's managed to command attention in the larger world outside of the Muslim community. So he's managed to attract a readership. So it's worth speaking about him in that way too. Third, he himself as a personality is absolutely fascinating. He's a figure from out of Shakespeare, and it's because of his family on one hand and his own ideas on the other hand. So
descended from the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which many people consider kind of a forerunner to Al-Qaeda and today's Islamists.
His grandfather was the Hassan al-Banna, who founded the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928. And then his father was Hassan al-Banna's son-in-law, and his father continued the project in Egypt and then in Europe in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. So Ramadan comes out of the very center of this. Al-Qaeda is not the Muslim Brotherhood, but it's the splinter of a splinter of the Muslim Brotherhood. So it's the absolute wild man splinter from this. And Ramadan comes from this background, and he has a lot of connections, also just family connections, to that splinter of a splinter. So, because the great philosopher to come out of the Muslim Brotherhood was a man named Sayyid Qutb, who was hanged by Nasser in 1966, and Qutb worked out a philosophy of Islam, or of Islamism, I should say, which was later adapted in a more radicalized and then adapted by the factions that produced Al-Qaeda. And Qutb was in a very close relation with Ramadan's father.
So that's just lineage. As
yes.
To Ramadan's own language and own writings, many others see him as interested in making Muslim identity compatible with Western democracy and see him as a force of moderation rather than radicalism among his many young Muslim devotees in the U.S., U.K. and elsewhere. So when Tariq Ramadan was on this program on April 8th, I asked him about your criticism that he has, in a way, two voices, one that he uses to speak to the West, the other that he uses to speak to devout Muslims. Let's listen to a little bit of his response.
And he's not quoting me. He is just, in fact, he's translating from French books into English. This was already said, and I've responded to this, and he's not reading my responses. I think it's not fair. It's intellectually without probity. And I would say I don't have time to waste with translators. If he is coming to talk to me about evidences, it's not this.
So I asked him, is there something fundamentally different between Islam and democracy, something irreconcilable?
I'm just using the image of a mountain. It's at the top, we have the shared common universal values, but the roots are different, and we are starting from different parts, and the valleys, there are many roots. What I'm saying is that our values, our histories, and our understanding, civilization, are quite different. You know, the Islamic civilization has a specific history, a specific, you know, set of or a system which is quite different. Now, when you go from the set of, and the system itself to the values, you understand that we have common values. When it comes to human dignity, when it comes to justice, when it comes to freedom, we may have different roots, but we end up at the same top of the mountain. This is where, for example, when people are saying, oh, in Islam we don't have democracy, I say, look, don't use the concept of democracy without coming to the principles that are behind democracy.
So that's a very interesting statement. And I could imagine if he was speaking to an audience of young Muslims trying to figure out what their political identity is, not to mention their religious identity, in the UK or North Africa or wherever it might be. And he was saying explicitly right there that the values of Western democracy and the values of Islam at the top of the mountain, as he put it, are the same. Justice, universal suffrage, things like that. Just they get there from different roots. Do you want to deconstruct that in a different way?
Yeah, well, I was scribbling notes madly while you were playing these quotes because I disagreed with nearly everything. First, my big point is not so much that he speaks differently to Muslim audiences than he does to other audiences. There is some writers in France do say that, and they document that a lot, and so I'm guessing that some of that is true, that he does speak that way. But I haven't seen that he speaks that way, and I don't base my own criticisms on him for that. I think if you read him closely enough, he says everything directly, and you just have to pay close attention. If you pay only light attention, it all sounds great. Or if you listen to him for the first 15 minutes, it sounds great. But then on the 16th minute, you begin to get troubled a little bit. And you can see that, I think, in what he's saying here. First, he said, it's interesting that he says about me that he won't even respond. And my criticisms are not, he doesn't deign to respond to them. They're not worth responding to. They're just translations and so forth. This is what he always says. In fact, he never responds to any of his critics. What he always does is insult them and explain that they're, you know, bad people in various ways. In my case, I happen to be a bad person because I see that I'm a translator from the French. It's not that bad, but he never responds.
And, well, he was saying it was an inaccurate translation.
Yes, well, that's what he always says. It's inaccurate. It's wrong. But he never actually answers the argument. What he's explaining by saying that there are shared values and different roots is really a way of saying that when he is a way that he has of allowing himself to use words that are understood in one way by the general public, but have a different meaning for himself, such as the word reformist. He describes himself as a reformist, an Islamic reformist, and he's in the Muslim reform movement. And by the word reform, everybody, the ordinary person would imagine that he means, well, all good things, and he wants to adapt the religion to liberal democracy, which is not hard to do, which is an easy and natural thing to do, and millions of people have done it, and that he's engaged in this project. But actually, he means something very specific, which is that the reformist movement has a specific meaning, like, let's say, the Dutch Reformed Church. It has a specific meaning. And this is the movement founded by his grandfather, Hassan al-Banna. It's the movement that comes out of the Muslim Brotherhood and engages more people than that.
But would Hassan al-Banna ever have said that Western democracy and Islam share the same ultimate common values?
No. No. And Saeed Ramadan, his father, played with some of this with saying this sort of thing. And Ramadan himself has gone further and says it outright. So in this one way, he's adopted a new position, and it sounds excellent. And if that's all there were to his position, I would be his fan, and I would write essays
then, so
in his
what,
honor.
What specifically, for an example, I realize we can't, you know, go into great detail about many, many of his writings. You take thousands of words to do that in print. But maybe one example that contradicts the top line statement that Islam and Western democracy are compatible?
Well, first of all, I believe that Islam and Western democracy are fully compatible.
But in terms of what he believes.
But I don't think that he believes it. And it's because of this notion of, that he has of this shared values coming from different roots. And so he thinks that he's deriving all these values from the Quran and from the sacred scriptures that follow the Quran. And what that finally means is that he wants to be in a position of obedience toward those people who claim to have the official interpretation of the Quran. So on one hand, he will say he's for liberal democracy, he's for all good things, he's for women's rights. And on the other hand, he will explain repeatedly that he feels feelings of reverence, and that we ought to have feelings of reverence, and we ought to look with respect and admiration on figures, on the grand authority figures of his particular movement within Islam, such as Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi. So his books are filled with expressions of this respect for
and
people like Qaradawi.
You think that's code for Western democracy really isn't compatible with Islamic thought?
Well, Qaradawi himself is in favor of exterminating the Jews. He supports suicide terrorism. He's just called for the ritual murder of the president of the Palestinian Authority. He's the single biggest theological champion of Hamas. He stands for all kinds of horrendous things. So I'm left in the position of wanting to say, Mr. Ramadan, how do you square the fact that on one hand you say you're for liberal democracy, on the other hand you tell us to revere this monstrous figure, Sheikh Qaradawi? I look at it and I think it just doesn't add up. It's very perplexing.
Paul Berman, my guest on WNYC, NYU professor. His new book is called The Flight of the Intellectuals. We'll continue in a minute. We'll take some of you who are waiting to speak on the phone, and we'll talk a little bit about whether the roots of Paul Berman's conflicts with some other so-called liberal intellectuals are in the post 9/11 period and the Iraq War debate, where some liberal internationalists thought, at least at the beginning, that that was a good thing. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we talk with NYU professor Paul Berman. His new book is called Flight of the Intellectuals, and let's take a call. Here's Jenny in Brooklyn. Hi, Jenny, you're on WNYC.
Hi, yes. In regards to Ayaan Hirsi Ali, mm-hmm. I cannot understand how, you know, a rational liberal person could not agree with her. She's promoting basic human rights, especially women's rights, and it's almost like she makes liberals too uncomfortable. She thinks outside their box. I was wondering what the guest thinks about that, and also why, at the same time, the same groups that are always attacking Ayaan Hirsi Ali or hostile to her never say anything about, you know, the worst dictators around the world, the leaders of Saudi Arabia, Sudan. They're largely silent on what's going on with women in Afghanistan.
Well, I do think that Ayaan Hirsi Ali is immensely admirable, and I think that all liberal-minded people should see a tremendous virtue in what she's doing. I think she's a great hero, too. Naturally, one can disagree with her on this or that point. She has 10,000 opinions, and she probably disagrees with herself on some of those opinions. I do think it's very strange, and I agree with the caller about this, that she's been attacked so thoroughly. Something about her gets under the skin of a lot of people. She's attacked in a grotesque manner. People look down their nose at her as if she isn't very intelligent, and then she gets in a debate with them, wipes them off the map, you know.
Well, here's a critic of Ayaan Hirsi Ali, Steve in Brooklyn. Steve, you're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I just feel that I've read her book, and I'm not terribly impressed by her as a public intellectual. I mean, she has an interesting story. But, really, she's more of a polemicist than anything else. And isn't she working for the Heritage Foundation or one of those big right-wing think tanks these days? I mean, she's really sort of transformed herself into a Somali Ann Coulter. She just throws bombs, and it's, sure, she's working for women's rights, but there's many, many people working for women's rights in the Islamic world that don't have her sort of crazy radical opinions on the side. And also, I one more point, and then I'll take my answer off the air. I don't understand why we continue to listen to people like Berman, who got the Iraq war so unbelievably wrong. Shouldn't that just sort of invalidate a lot of what they say? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. On Ayaan Hirsi Ali and right-wing ties?
Yeah. Well, I think this is a way of not engaging in a debate. It's true she got a job at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. And how generous of them to give her a job. This was someone who had to flee Holland. She fled Somalia to Holland, that she had to flee Holland because terrorists were after her. And somebody gave her a job. And that's great. And we should all feel happy about it. And yet, because she got a job with a conservative organization, she ends up being declared to be beyond the pale. People won't listen to her, and this sort of thing. And I see the listener likewise doesn't think it's worth talking with me either. So this is a kind of mindset that stands in the way of an open debate. I don't think she's an Ann Coulter. I think she's a very thoughtful person. I think she's done I don't think that Ann Coulter has done anything of value, but I think Ayaan Hirsi Ali has raised some really great issues, and she's done it very effectively. And it has to do with women's rights. It has to do with a very difficult issue of genital mutilation in Africa and issues like that. And she's absolutely been at the forefront of these issues.
And on the Iraq war, you were on the show in the lead up to the Iraq war when there was a debate among what are labeled liberal internationalists as to whether that might be worth it, not for the sake necessarily of toppling a regime that didn't have anything to do with 9/11, but that may or may not have had weapons of mass destruction, but for the freedom from Saddam Hussein that it would bring to Iraqis. Did you come to regret that position?
No. I was on the show actually in the very first days of the war, and I remember it grimly because news events were taking place as you and I talked, Brian, and some of them were a little ominous, and they already suggested that Rumsfeld had bungled it disastrously. I think in retrospect, I think it was right to overthrow Saddam. I think it was wrong to do it the way we did do it. I think that it could have been done differently. I myself, before the war, was warning about it. I wrote a long piece in the New Republic in February 2003, warning that the Bush administration was leading us over the cliff. And I think that we were therefore in a difficult position. It was right to overthrow him. It was wrong to do it the way we did it. In some ways, the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War have turned out to be quite similar in that way. It was right to overthrow the Taliban, but it was wrong to do that the way we did it too, and we're paying the cost for that now. So I was against Bush before the war. I was against him afterwards. I've always been against him. I think the man was absolutely incompetent.
Hesham in Staten Island. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. Before I comment on the former Muslims in Iraq and Ayaan Hirsi Ali, I would like to mention two maybe unintentional mistakes from Professor Berman. He portrayed Qaradawi and Tariq Ramadan as like friends or have similar views, while I know for a fact that Qaradawi dislikes what he assumes liberal views of Tariq Ramadan's. On the other hand, Professor Berman also said that Qaradawi wants to exterminate the Jews. I don't know what is the source of that. I don't think it is the case. Now, speaking about Ayn Hirsi Ali in Iraq, I support everybody's freedom of choice. If any Muslim wants to leave Islam, I'm supporting that 100%, and I have proof from the Quran and the Sunnah to support that. Now, the problem that happens with many of these examples, that their experience is mixed, part religious and part culture and part custom and part what happened to them personally, like in the case of Ayn Hirsi Ali, which I feel bad, of course, for what she's been through. But the problem is they put all this together and portray it as only Islam. You know what I mean? There is a lot of politics, there is a lot of culture, there is a lot of misconceptions mixed in with what they say. So with that, I will listen up there, and thank you very much.
Thank you for your call. So it's not just the religion that led her parents to, what, try to get her into a forced marriage?
Yeah.
And, you know, that there are also politics and culture that go beyond Islam per se.
Well, Ayn Hirsi Ali has had her own personal experience with religion, so she's concluded that her personal experience is the correct gives her a correct interpretation of the entire religion. So she's turned against the religion. I agree with the caller on this, and other people have responded in different ways. And of course, there are many pious Muslims who might agree with Ayn Hirsi Ali on many points and dislike Tariq Ramadan on many points and yet remain pious Muslims. So, of course, it's a very large debate. The caller also raised the question of Sheikh Qaradawi and Ramadan, and this is very important. And the caller is absolutely correct in saying that there's been a quarrel between these two men, and it's a relatively recent quarrel. I don't think it's a very substantial quarrel, but it remains the case that Ramadan tells us over and over in his books to revere Qaradawi. Qaradawi seems to be his great guru, with whom he's had a few differences, and but there's just no denying that that Ramadan is telling us to admire him. In my book, The Flight of the Intellectuals, I just have a million quotations from Ramadan telling us to do this. The caller also asked, is it true that Qaradawi has called for the extermination of the Jews? Unfortunately, it's true. I don't even want to read the quotation on the radio. Mm. It's too horrible. He does call for this, and he's called for it recently, and he called for it in 2009, which is the same year when Ramadan came out with yet more paeans to the greatness of Sheikh Qaradawi.
We're almost out of time, but two last things. One, if somebody is positioning themselves as a liberal and a liberal intellectual, and somebody like Ayn Hirsi Ali or Irshad Manji or whoever comes out as a liberal critic of Islam, but then aligns themselves with Dick Cheney and the real neocon wing and U.S. foreign policy, a liberal is going to say, wait a minute, this person is proclaiming liberal values?
Okay, well, I mean, the important thing, I detest Dick Cheney myself, but the important thing about the word liberal in this context is not that it refers to the factions of American politics, but that it refers to the basic questions of human rights, the dignity of the individual, the right and the necessity to think for yourself, to think rationally, not to draw all your opinions from authority, not just to adopt positions because somebody in a position of authority instructs you to do so. And so liberal in this sense really means liberal democratic civilization.
And last thing, you told the New York Observer that Iran is going to be another big fault line among different stripes of liberal intellectuals. And you said the question is, what is the Muslim world? Do we have to answer that question in order to decide whether to, say, bomb an Iranian nuclear facility?
No. I mean, I don't think it makes much sense to talk about a Muslim world. I mean, there are 1.5 billion Muslims who are all over the place in terms of opinion. And Iran is a place where I think liberal intellectuals have split, because some of us support with real enthusiasm the dissidents in Iran and the people in the streets, the radicals who want to overthrow the Islamic Republic, and other people want to be very timid and quiet about this. And this is a kind of a basic issue.
Paul Berman, NYU professor, author now of The Flight of the Intellectuals. Maybe you know some of his previous works, Terror and Liberalism, A Tale of Two Utopias, The Political Journey of the Generation of 1968, and Power and the Idealists. But now it's The Flight of the Intellectuals by Paul Berman. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Sherry Parks on black females as superwomen. Stay tuned.